Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today's show unusually features excerpts from 5 of the 16 interviews I've done over the last 6 years with the Greek economist Yannis Varoufakis, mainly about the euro crisis. Varoufakis has now stepped into one of the most important posts in the political economic world, finance minister in the new Syriza government in Greece. The show will close with Varoufakis' recommendation on how Greece should approach negotiation with its creditors. Very strong stuff, but I don't want to spoil the ending, so stay tuned. Before proceeding, I want to say that I've seen too many purists criticizing Syriza for various debasements and compromises. Give them some time to do something before pounding the pulpit, okay? Also, have you ever tried to run a government in a hostile world? The economist Yannis Varoufakis was born in Athens in 1961. He did his graduate work in Britain in the 1980s and then taught at the University of Sydney from 1989 to 2000. He then went back to Greece, the University of Athens, where he held a post until he resigned to run for parliament several weeks ago. When the Greek economic crisis hit, it had become impossible for him to do his work in Athens, so he took a position first as resident economist at Valve Software, the gaming company, and then a visiting position at the University of Texas. Only about a month ago, he decided to run for parliament in the Greek election that produced a victory by his party, Syriza, last weekend. Almost immediately, he was chosen by the new prime minister, Alexis Tsipras, to be the country's finance minister. In that role, he's going to be the principal negotiator with the country's creditors. What kind of deal emerges from those negotiations is going to be one of the most important issues in the realm of political economy in a long time. I've gotten to know Yannis a bit over these years that we've been talking and corresponding. He strikes me as an extremely serious, intelligent guy who is radical, but sane. He and his colleagues in the government will have to scare Germany, the European Central Bank, the European Commission, and the IMF just the right amount if they're going to get concessions out of them. The creditors will make a lot of threats, and it's going to take nerves of steel not to yield to them. This first interview was done in December 2008. Greece was entering recession, as was the whole world, but the dimensions of the crisis were not yet clear. Riots in Athens drew worldwide attention, prompting my first call to Yannis Varoufakis. Your country is exploding. Obviously, the death of the youth is what set things off. But what is behind this, all the rioting in the streets?
As always, with such explosions, social explosions, there isn't just one cause. But if we have to pin it down, I'd say that since the mid-1990s, Greek society has undergone a major modernization drive, let's say. And that drive had some real effect in terms of increasing GDP, gross national product, let's say. It raised a lot of expectations. And then, let's say in the last 3 or 4 years, these expectations were not fulfilled for the vast majority of the population. With the onslaught of the financial crisis, some serious financial scandals involving the government, and an authoritarian turn of the police, the circumstances were ripe for the explosion, the social explosion that you mentioned, and all that it took was a spark of the killing of a 15-year-old schoolboy. And suddenly we have the riots that we have on the street, in the streets of Athens, but not just Athens, almost the whole of the country.
Who is participating in the street activities? Is it mostly young people, or is it broader than that?
I think that the vast majority are youngsters. They are 15 to 18-year-olds. Those are the people who are sort of confronting the police forces. Now, yesterday, on Wednesday, there was a national strike called by the trade unions. Mind you, that strike had been called weeks in advance. It had already been planned for yesterday. And what happened was that there was an interesting convergence, a kind of coalescence between the trade union, the older stalwarts of the labor movement, and the 15-year-olds who suddenly merged on the streets. The demonstration passed off quite nicely while the older people were on the streets. They are quite good at safeguarding their marches. But then when they disappeared, when they went home, further riots started between the youngsters and the police.
And how have the police been reacting to the riots?
Clumsily. Brutally, incompetently. They will attack quite often bypassers, usually young people who have nothing to do with riots. They will leave the rioters and the looters alone. if the police wanted to design an intervention that would have the least effect in terms of law and order and the greatest effect in terms of culminating hatred towards them, they could not have done a better job than what they have done.
Now, I read in the New York Times this morning that the government's reaction has been rather tolerant. Is that misinformation?
I would say so. Things are not as, you know, just sort of black and white as they seem. Let me give you a very brief example which conveys the situation, I think, quite well. All right. Compare and contrast the following two situations, both of which I was a witness to. You're sitting in a cafe with sort of older intellectuals, pseudo-intellectuals like myself, in the city center, just chatting and having coffee. Suddenly, riot police come in. They beat people up without asking any questions, without doing any searches, without any provocation whatsoever, and then they leave. Okay, that's episode number one. Episode number two. A house was burgled the other day. I called the police, and they never came. They never turned up. So there is this combination of brutality with no explanation, with no reason, and then either towards criminals or to rioters, complete and utter tolerance. So what do you make of that?
Of course, now, a generation ago, Greece was run by a military regime. Are there memories being excited of that period?
Well, they have never gone away. Even amongst the youth of today, the 15 and the 16-year-olds who were not born back then, the experience of not just one dictatorship in the 1967 to 1974 period, but a prolonged, slow-burning authoritarian regime from the mid-1930s to the mid-1970s, it has left it an indelible mark on most people, including the youngsters.
Let's talk about the broader Greek economy. You talked about a little bit about this earlier. I assume that Greece has gone through the kind of neoliberalization that many other countries around the world have gone through in the last decade or two.
That's absolutely right. And by popular consent, in the early 1990s, speaking from a microeconomic point of view, Greece was a basket case. You know, we had 17, 18, 20% inflation. The Greek currency, the drachma, as it was then, was sort of, you know, in a state of permanent crisis. Productivity was incredibly low, and living standards were falling behind. The socialist government, social democratic government of the mid-1990s, decided to simply, you know, adopt the neoliberal policies of the European Union. They did a pretty good job of it, in the sense that they managed to reduce inflation down to 3% from a high of 20%, and to have Greece, against all odds, accepted in the Eurozone. At the same time, a remarkable period of growth ensued from 1994 up until last year, let's say, of more than 4% a year, which is not, by Chinese standards, is not great, but by European standards, it was pretty good. And you could see that there was wealth being accumulated. Mind you, the distribution of this wealth was particularly skewed. And moreover, I think that what has added to the sense of injustice amongst the youth of Greece today is that the ruling class, let's put it simply, the rich, are cordoning their own children off. They have their own private schools in which they're taught an international baccalaureate curriculum intended for their offspring to go overseas, abroad, United States, United Kingdom, and so on and so forth, where to study. And they have separated them, sort of segregated them from the public education system of Greece, which means that Greece has become a country in which the ruling class, the elites, have no stake in the education system. And yet, at the same time, the Greek educational system keeps churning out a very large proportion of well-educated youngsters who are condemned to dead-end jobs, if they can get one, paying something like, in American dollars, something like $900,000 a month, in a country where a cappuccino costs $5. Therefore, this, to some extent, at least, explains the frustration that those hordes of quite well-educated youngsters feel.
And as you're saying, it was distributed quite unequally.
Terribly so. We have been here at the University of Athens, we've been undertaking a study recently, in the last few months, on inequality, and in particular on poverty rates. And it turns out that Greece has the second highest poverty proportion in the whole of Europe, the 27 European countries. And moreover, the social security system is failing to dampen that. And so what you have is a classic case of a contradiction whereby high growth and significant growth and wealth creation cohabits with the generation of poverty that we haven't had for many decades.
This sounds in many ways like the American economy. We're used to it here. Has it been a shock to the Greeks to see this kind of unequal development?
It has been, because in particular because the 1980s was a completely different era. It was an era that some of my economist colleagues think of as a period of stagnation in terms of GDP growth and so on, and it was not growing very fast. But in the period from 1981 to 1986-87, there was a massive redistribution of income towards the poor. And that had created a set of expectations that the lower strata would catch up. And the narrative and the rhetoric of the elites in the 1990s fueled those expectations. The argument was a standard trickle-down effect. That is, you know, we will do things that will increase incomes at the top, and those will trickle down further. And so the 1980s are going to be thought of as a period of failure compared to the 1990s and this current decade, because not only are we going to have redistribution, but we're going to have a steady increases of the pie. Well, the pie did increase, but I would say that the living standards of the bottom 40% of the population have deteriorated.
That was an excerpt from an interview with the Greek economist Yannis Varoufakis, first broadcast in December 2008. Next, an excerpt from an interview first broadcast in March 2010. This, an analysis of the cause of the Eurozone crisis. Yannis Varoufakis, who is now the finance minister of Greece, did I say? Welcome, Yannis. Your country is giving the world a headache. Tell us what's been happening.
My country is in the grip of a major, major crisis. The headache is all ours. But it seems to me that Greece is being used as the spear by which a particular turn following the 2008 crisis is going to affect the whole of the Eurozone to begin with.
All right, well, let's review some of the recent economic history of Greece. What's been happening? Has Greece been in recession with the rest of the world lately?
Well, look, Greece entered the Eurozone in 2000. On the run-up to 2000, Greece, in order to get into the Eurozone, did everything that was asked of it by the powers that be in Brussels, in the center of the European Union. And indeed, it achieved a major miracle in reducing inflation from 18% to 3%, pushing interest rates down, and thus managing to enter the club of the euro. It was a fragile economy, always has been, an economy which is in deficit, trade deficit with the rest of Europe. And to put it very bluntly, when the shock waves of the earthquake of 2008 hit Greece, because it was the weak link in Europe, it was the one to tumble first. There is no doubt that our governments, especially the one between 2000, 2004 and 2007, ran up a large fiscal deficit. So in that sense, you could say that Greece was in a precarious position due to its own fiscal irresponsibility. This is the line that is pushed by the Financial Times, by the Wall Street Journal, by Brussels and Frankfurt. The fact of the matter, however, is that the reasons why Greece has landed in the mire in which it finds itself at the moment has very little to do with fiscal irresponsibility. And let me give you an example. Take Spain. Spain, up until 2008, was the blue-eyed boy or girl of the European Union, in the sense that it was actually running a surplus in the government budget. It had regulations for its banking sector that were far better and more stringent than anything that the United States, the United Kingdom, or France or Germany had managed. And yet, look at Spain now. Spain, even though it was doing everything right according to the prescriptions of the powers that be, isn't exactly the same situation as Greece is now. And indeed, if Spain blows up the way that Greece is blowing up, the repercussions are going to be much worse. So what's happening? I think what's happening is very simple. The Eurozone is a currency union. It's like the United States. The United States is a currency union. So, you know, New York and California and Ohio and North Carolina, you have the same currency. But if Ohio, for instance, is experiencing much slower growth than California, and if it has a trade deficit with the rest of the United States, no one in the United States is going to turn around and say, well, you know, this is too bad, get out of the union, or you have to deal with your problems all by yourself. In the Eurozone, you've got a currency union, but no political union. So, to put it very simply, in 2008, we had a complete credit crunch worldwide. In the United States, we had the massive bailouts that you know better than I, so I don't need to delve into that. In the European Union, we did not. And we did not for a very simple reason. Germany and Holland, but mainly Germany, are primarily in control of the monetary policy in Frankfurt and regarding the euro. And they have a very simple policy for getting out of the crisis. Obama has the policy of using the Federal Reserve and the Treasury in order to inject as much cash into the economy as is necessary in order to keep the economy going. Germany is trying to get out of the crisis by exporting to the rest of the world. Now, up until 2008, Germany was exporting to the United States, to China, to Latin America. It had a trade surplus. Since then, because of the collapse in demand from your neck of the woods, from China and Latin America, the only countries with which Germany still enjoys trade surplus are countries in the Eurozone, like Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Ireland, and so on. And look, and this is the incongruity. They have this policy of not inflating their economy, unlike the United States and Britain, and trying to get out of the crisis by creating demand through exports. Exports to whom? To us, to the rest of the Eurozone. So they want to have a surplus, but they don't want us to have a deficit.
It also seems to be that there's a problem with the German strategy in that to be a proper hegemon, as the United States has been for the last 50, 60 years, you have to spend a little recklessly. You have to spread the money around and run deficits with the rest of the world to stabilize the system. Now, we may be running into the vital contradictions of that now, but that's, you know, 5 or 6 decades it's been fairly successful. Germany does not seem to be willing to step into that role. Is Germany just not up to the role of dominating the Eurozone the way the United States has been to the rest of the world?
I think you hit the nail right on the head. Germany has been, from the early 1950s up until 2008, let's say, it has been enjoying the fact that it was the United States that was, as the hegemon, as you said, creating the demand for the German surplus. In 2008, that story ended. I do not think that the political elite of Germany, and this is, I think, the tragedy of Europe at the moment, the problem is not countries like Greece or Spain or Portugal who are running a deficit. The problem of the Eurozone is Germany, because they have not understood exactly the point that you raised, that in order to maintain their leading position and their capacity to accumulate capital and to grow technologically and so on, they have to have demand for their goods. The United States knew this very well about Germany and supported German surplus creation for decades. As of 2008, that story has ended. Germany now thinks that it can get away, it get out of this crisis by pretending that there is no problem with regard to demand for its goods in places like Greece and places like France and Italy and so on and so forth. And and they are hiding behind this neo-mercantilist mentality. I was talking to an officer of the ECB, the European Central Bank, who happened to be German. And of course, you know, that bank is in Frankfurt. It is nothing more than the extension of the old Bundesbank, the Central Bank of Germany. And I put exactly the point you raised to him. And I was astonished by the reaction. He said, you know what? You're right. What we're doing is probably going to push countries like yours into recession, into permanent recession. And I said, yes, but aren't you worried that this is going to stop us from buying your goods, buying your exports? And in a twist of quasi-intelligence, he said this to me. He said, well, we are pushing wage deflation towards you. We're forcing you effectively to reduce wages. But you know what? Wage earners in your country do not buy Mercedes-Benz. It is the elites of countries like yours who do. And we're going to look after them. We're going to ensure that there are transfers of European money, effectively German money, to Greece to build roads and metro stations and improve telecommunications. And the people who benefit from that are the elites and perhaps the migrants, migrant labor. Greek wage laborers, we don't care for, because they, in any case, they buy Chinese or Korean. So they might as well reduce their demand for imports into the Eurozone. I thought that was brilliant, but I thought that what was terrifying was that it was so wrong. Because if we have a negative growth of around 5 to 8%, which is what I predict is going to happen next year, given the wage deflation that is being pushed down our throat at the moment, I think that the elites are going to find it very, very hard to maintain their demand for German products too. So my accusation for the Germans is that they're not that they're being selfish or misanthropic, but they are being a bit idiotic.
That was the second of five excerpts from interviews I've done over the years with the Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis. It was first broadcast in March 2010. Let's take a musical break. There's a bit of Yanis Xenakis and Shima, performed by Les Jeunes Soloistes, led by Rashid Safir. Greek music in honor of our Greek content. Of it, the composer said in 1975, the year he wrote it, the melodic patterns of Enshima are drawn from a computer-plotted graph as a result of Brownian movement, random walk theory, that I introduced into sound synthesis with the computer in the pressure versus time domain. So there you go. Next, an excerpt from an interview first broadcast in November 2010, based on Varoufakis' modest proposal to end the euro crisis, which went through many written and spoken iterations. While you might say that it provides a blueprint for a strategy now that he's the Greek finance minister, that is complicated by the fact that there's almost no chance that the euro core would agree to it. Still, it's worth thinking about. Okay, let's turn now to your idea of how to do things better, the modest proposal that you wrote up for M.R. Zine. How would you go about resolving this crisis more sensibly and more humanely?
Well, it's a very simple proposal, really, and it comprises of two parts. The first part aims at stabilizing the situation. When you're in the middle of a crisis, when your house is burning down, the first thing you need to do is call the fire brigade to come in and extinguish it. So that's the first part. This is the stabilization part. And then the second part concerns rebuilding, recovery. What do you do in order to assist the recovery to the end, to create safety valves and a safety system which will ensure that the crisis will not happen again? So let's take these two steps one at a time. The first one, how do you stop this crisis, this contagion that we just described above? a moment ago. Well, I think that, as I said before, this is a debt crisis, but it's also a banking crisis, which is becoming a real economy crisis. So you have two manifestations of the crisis. And what you need to do is you need to attack them both at once. So the first suggestion is that instead of having bilateral discussions and negotiations between the center being the European Union, the Eurozone, the ECB, the IMF, this is one pole, and a problematic state like the Greek one, instead of having these bilateral negotiations that end up with an austerity drive in the particular country that gets nowhere, instead of having that, the proposal is very simple. Bring together the representatives of all high deficit countries, countries like Greece, Ireland, Spain, Italy, and so on. Okay, that's one pole. Of course, the ECB and the Eurozone, that's the second one, but also representatives of all main European banks holding the majority of the high deficit countries' bonds and force upon them an agreement. I think we said that before. That would reduce the total amount of debt, and it would steady the nerves of the markets, and it would steady the nerves of the bankers, who are now owed sums that they have more or less written off. They don't think they will ever get it, because they know that the austerity packages imposed upon the countries through these bilateral negotiations will not work. That's the basic idea. At the same time, you need, in order to stabilize things, you need the equivalent of fiscal policy. Now, we don't have a U.S. Treasury here to run a stimulus package, which we never really had in Europe. But what we do have, Doug, we have something called the European Investment Bank, which, you know, is the size, in terms of its funding capacity, it's twice the size of the World Bank. And it can unleash funds to deficit regions of Europe for the purposes of investing in productive activities, not giving loans to laggards, that will steady the all in the level of investment and in economic activity. That's in the short run. In the longer run, once the freefall has been arrested and the economy, the European economy, is stabilized, what we need is to redesign the euro in order to ensure that, to enable recovery and to ensure that in the future, these crises do not pose such a huge threat to the whole architecture of the euro. And the idea here is very, very simple. The first thing I would do is create EU bonds, like you have U.S. Treasury bills in the United States. We can have you see, one thing that most people don't understand, they don't know, is that the European Union has zero debt. The European Union has zero debt. Its member states have debt. The European Union doesn't have any debt. It's very attractive for investors around the world to have the prospect of buying EU-issued bonds, which they can be used in order to replace, let's say, 60% of the sovereign debt of all the member states could be converted into European Union bonds. And that would be costless. And the interest rate that would be payable by all the member states would then be much lower. Secondly, you would have a situation where the European Investment Bank, that I mentioned a moment ago, is authorized to embark on large-scale investments throughout Europe perpetually. Green technologies, efficiency enhancement, infrastructure, poverty reduction, urban renewal, all these things are things that the European Investment Bank can invest in. It has the capacity, it has the remit to issue its own bonds. And also, at the moment, a percentage of this funding has to come from member states. Well, this could come from European Union bonds if they are created. Now, the combination of the stabilization process that I described with this very simple change in the architecture of the euro, with the creation of European Union bonds, would change the scene and it would have the capacity to create the circumstances that would lead to recovery for the European continent. And the beauty of this proposal, and the reason why we call it a modest proposal, is this. it doesn't really need any major constitutional treaty changes. All the ingredients of bringing about this change are in place. The European Investment Bank is in place. The European Central Bank is in place. All we need is to allow, firstly, for a rational agreement between the center, the member states, particularly the deficit member states, and the European banks, in order to stabilize the economy. We don't need constitutional changes for that. And then we need to empower the European Central Bank to issue the equivalent of United States Treasury bills, and by which to fund recovery and future growth and social cohesion in Europe.
The proposal that you're outlining, aside from its economic dimensions, would also promote greater political cohesion in Europe, which is rather lacking now, right?
Exactly. It would set the scene without being maximalist. Because, you see, now, I mean, I understand entirely and fully that if any political leader canvasses federation, it would have absolutely no luck whatsoever. But we don't need any major change. We don't need to go towards federation in order to create an effective Eurozone structure that will surreptitiously, without us even realizing it, bind together the disparate regions of Europe and the disparate countries of Europe into something much more cohesive than we have at the moment, and effectively reinvigorate democracy, because the average European has lost trust in the capacity of European democracy to create the circumstances for progress in the future.
Is there a third alternative, something besides what you propose, which is sensible and humane but hardly revolutionary? Something besides that and the austerity prescriptions coming from the orthodox, which is leading to deflation, depression, and a possible breakup of the Eurozone. Is there some other way out of this?
No, I sincerely think that there is no alternative. I think that if we don't go down a road similar to this, to the one that I outlined, the euro is going to break up. I don't know what will happen once it breaks up. I don't think anyone is going to be particularly happy once it does. But I can't see any alternative to that. With a possible exception, if there is a miracle worldwide and growth picks up in the United States significantly, and it does so in the rest of the world, if that happens, then it would be possible for the Eurozone to be dragged out by external forces of its desperate situation. But then all that will happen is we will buy time until the next economic downturn, because every time there is a significant downturn, the euro structure proves its incapability of absorbing the shocks.
Finally, some of my more radical friends think that the countries in crisis like Greece should just pull out of the euro and pursue a more nationalistic, autarkic economic strategy, something like Argentina did earlier this decade. What do you think of this approach?
I wish I could agree. Argentina is a special case. Argentina is doing relatively well because, firstly, it didn't have a choice. There was no way it could stay within the environment it found itself in up until the year 2000. The reason, however, it's doing well is because it is a major primary goods producer and it has been attached to China. China is saving countries like Brazil and Argentina and is creating completely new circumstances and new opportunities of growth. Greece is not a primary good producer, and of course, Greece is in the euro. The tragedy of being in the euro is that it's a little bit like the last line in Hotel California. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave, if you recall the song. We can't leave, and technically we can't leave. Let's say that the Greek government wanted to get out of the euro. How does it do it, technically? What happens with the euro that I have in my pocket and in my bank account? They cannot confiscate it, and they cannot forcibly convert it to whatever new currency we end up having here in Greece, the drachma, I suppose, or a new drachma. They would have to violate European Council human rights legislation. And even if they could do that, then I think most people would dash to the bank before the government introduces these changes and remove all their euros, and we would have an economy, a two-speed economy. Most people would be using the euro, a bit like Kosovo. Kosovo is using the euro at the moment, even though it's not a member of the eurozone. It will become a protectorate if something like this happens. So what I would say to your radical friends, it's what I say to my radical friends who say similar things to me, is that if this were 1999 and we had a referendum, should we get into the euro or not, I would have voted against. But once you're into the euro, there are non-linearities. You can't get out and expect to find yourself in the place you were once.
That was an excerpt from the November 2010 interview with Yanis Varoufakis. Next, in the fourth of five Yanis Varoufakis interview excerpts, a piece of a July 2012 interview about his time spent with Valve Software, a gaming company, as an economist hired to study its monetary dynamics. Apologies for the breakup in the Skype signal. Blame it on an imperfect internet connection in a country house. Welcome, Yanis. So you've got a new job with a software company. How'd this come about?
Well, last November, I was going to visit the United States, and indeed we met together, Doug, in New York when I was there on a lecture tour promoting my book, my latest book. Before I left Greece, I received an email which I nearly erased, because it was an email from a video game company, and I have no connection at all with the world of video games, and I thought, okay, that's another piece of spam. But I noticed that it said, well, I'm the CEO of a video game company, and I've been following your Euro Crisis blog. And I thought, this sounds interesting. So I read on. And he continued saying that when he and his colleagues at Valve, this is the name of the company, were trying to blend together different gaming interfaces. I had no idea what that meant, but it was interesting what followed. So while they were trying to blend together the different gaming interfaces, they suddenly realized that, oh my God, this is Greece and this is Germany, two different gaming interfaces, and they were trying to blend them together with a common digital currency, which sounded to them very much like the euro. And then because he was reading my Euro Crisis blog, he thought, oh, that may not be such a good idea, so why don't I talk to this guy? So that's how it started. He invited me to go to his company and to their company, actually, and consult with them for a couple of days. I said no, because I had a lot of things to do during that lecture tour, but then he insisted. I went, and it only took a day to realize that something weird and wonderful is happening there, and I wanted to be involved.
I know nothing about games, and I imagine a lot of listeners know nothing about games. Why would an economist be interested in this gaming ecosystem, as they say?
I know nothing about games myself. And you know what? I'm not really interested in them either, even though I've been working with Valve now for a few months. I still haven't played a single one of their games. But I'll tell you what the answer to your question is. Because suddenly, when the first hour I was there, I encountered an amazing, very real economy. It may be digital, it may be happening in people's computers, but it's very real. In what sense? There is exchange, there is production, there is income generation, there is distribution, and that involves 90 million people, something like $1 billion, real US dollars. That's like a small country. And
where do the dollars come from? People have to pay to play?
Yes, indeed. There are two ways in which, there are a variety of ways that money finds itself into the system. Most old-fashioned is you pay subscription, monthly subscription, in order to participate in a game. Then, once you're in the game, and now increasingly those subscriptions are waived and people get in for free, and then once they're in there, they can continue to play freely, or if they want to buy certain items that have utility to them during the game, they can go to the store, which is called Steam, and purchase those items. But beyond that, what's fascinating is that then, once they have these items, either through hunting-gathering, because they found them, or because they bought them, they can trade them. So you have a barter economy, which is created. And like in every economy, there is room for arbitrage. So people who are astute traders can actually make quite a bit of money in the sense that they accumulate items which are of value to other players. And initially what they did was that they would get out of that platform and go to eBay and auction them off for real dollars. So you have hundreds of thousands of people who actually make a very good living out of playing the games, and hundreds of thousands of people, and that's even more fascinating, who make a lot of money out of producing stuff. So
what is produced and how?
Well, it's the same model as the applications, the apps on the iPhone and the iPad, you know, the Apple idea, that independent designers can design an app and put it on iTunes, and they get a share of the revenue that Apple gets from selling that on iTunes. So this is exactly the same. Let's say that you develop a very beautiful hat that somebody wants to wear in one of those games. You can place it on the trading platform, Steam it's called, it's equivalent of iTunes, and you retain a percentage of the revenue that Apple gets. And as I said, there are hundreds of thousands of designers who make a very good living out of doing that. But the most fascinating thing for me was that you could actually see, you know, Doug, we economists, we have to make do with really bad quality data that is compiled by some statistical office. And you know, it's like sausages. You really don't want to know how they were made, those statistics.
But then apply very sophisticated mathematical techniques to very dirty data.
Oh, yes, of course. This is what we economists do. And it's real rubbish in, dangerous rubbish out. But Valve, you feel like God. You're omniscient because you have access to everything everyone is doing in that economy at any point in time. You don't need statistics.
Oh, and I know you're just beginning this, but are there lessons for the real world that you can see?
It's early days for me to give you a definitive answer as to what they are. I can tell you that there are. I can tell you that, for instance, you know, the philosophical debate and political debate concerning free market versus the state. You realize by looking at this economy how bunk that distinction is. You can't have markets without a state, and you can't have a state without markets. So this is a false dilemma, and you can see this because these economies emerge spontaneously. No one created them. Valve and other gaming companies found themselves with economies in their midst. You know, these games were created by computer software gaming geeks. They had no intention of creating economies. Those economies emerged spontaneously. And yet, very quickly, those very same game designers found themselves in the role of regulator. It's not because they were, you know, big bad government wanting to regulate free market activity. It was just without regulation, the market would collapse immediately. And another very important lesson that you actually see in front of your eyes evolve in real time is that, you know, when people are, to quote Adam Smith, tracking and bartering and exchanging and therefore creating markets and building up value, which is distributed on the basis of demand and supply, how quickly that process, when unregulated, leads to instability and breakdowns.
So the market then is not a principle of spontaneous order as the Hayekians would have it.
Well, actually, there is spontaneous order. It's a very unstable order. Let's not forget Beirut during the civil war in the Lebanon. Did see instances of spontaneous order, you know, even though there was no state for more than a decade and there were all these warlords fighting one another. Still, Beirut managed to function to have some degree of electricity supply, some water supply. It just wasn't a very good order.
That was some of the July 2012 interview with Yannis Varoufakis about his time spent with Valve Software. Another fifth of five interview excerpts with Yannis Varoufakis, first broadcast in November 2014. At the beginning, we talked some about the Geithner tapes. These are the transcripts of notes that former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner dictated to the ghostwriter of his memoirs that were obtained and published by the Financial Times. They show an incredibly dysfunctional Euro elite, so eager to punish Greece for being an irresponsible debtor and forgetting about Germany as an irresponsible lender, that they made the Euro crisis far worse. The version of events published in the Geithner book was far milder than these F-word-laced raw notes. Yannis Varoufakis. Were you surprised by the revelation of the Geithner tapes?
In a way, I was. Seasoned politicians like the German finance minister, the Dutch finance minister, would not realize that these conversations are going to see the light of day one day, and they will be judged depending on the phraseology that they use. I was not surprised by the sentiments that they expressed, but it just goes to show what kind of state of mind they were, and it was not a good state.
The frank desire to punish Greece, we kind of got that, but the brutality and frankness of it were shocking.
Indeed, it just goes to show that they had absolutely no concept of what this crisis that they were facing was all about. They were utterly in the dark. They had assumed, they had allowed themselves to believe that this was a case of, of one rogue failed state that had overborrowed, and it was causing problems for the rest of Europe.
Yeah, I've been thinking for ever since this crisis broke out that the European elite was really just not ready for prime time as a ruling class on a significant scale, and this really only confirmed it. They seemed to have no sense of what was going on, no sense of the gravity of the situation, and no sense of what their cheap sadism was going to do to the larger world.
Indeed, and Doug, it's worse. 4.5 years later, they still are clueless. If you look at the conversations that are going on in Brussels and in Frankfurt and in Paris now, this day, as we speak, you'll find that there has been no significant evolution in their thinking. They're still stuck in utterly ridiculous, antiquated views of what went on and what is continuing to go on.
Is there more here than meets the eye? Is this really a cramped worldview German ordo liberalism run rampant, or is there some way that we've talked about this before, but in what material sense does Germany gain from having put the southern part of Europe through a ringer?
In during the last 4 years, Germany has gained significantly. Long term, it's going to be the greatest loser, just like the Allies after the Great War, having imposed the Versailles Treaty on defeated Germany, in the end lost more than Germany than Germany did. I think that we have a repeat performance of that sorry historical episode. In the last 4 years, in the short term, Germany benefited, and benefited in two important ways. One was that deposits, bank deposits, fled countries like Spain, Ireland, Greece, and ended up in Frankfurt seeking safety. And that allowed the Frankfurt banks, like Deutsche Bank, like Finanzbank, to cover up the black holes, the deep, serious insolvency issues that they were facing. Secondly, a great deal of capital flowed into Germany in the form of bonds. German bonds were selling like hotcakes. So to the extent that interest payments were reduced substantially, we've reached a stage where Germany borrows, the German state borrows at 0.8-0.9%. I mean, we haven't had such low yields, low interest rates, since, I believe, the 15th century in Genoa. And that has allowed Germany to reduce its debt-to-GDP ratio as a result of the crisis. In the first couple of years, 3 years, Germany managed to replace some of the markets that it lost to the imploding European periphery with China. But now that is turning around in a not a nice way for Germany. So this is why I'm saying that long-term, Germany is going to suffer tremendously.
Well, what have the Germans done with that capital? I mean, that's in a sense the liability side of the balance sheet. What have they done with the capital that's flown in?
Oh, they're exporting it as if there is no tomorrow. And indeed, because they have pushed through austerity, they have pushed the whole of the Eurozone into becoming a greater Germany. I don't know whether you've noticed, but the Eurozone as a whole now has something like $400 billion of a current account surplus. And all that is beginning to be exported to the rest of the world. And Germany ends up owning a lot of dodgy financial assets from the rest of the world.
So this sounds like more problems in the future.
For the global economy. Jack Lew, quite correctly, last November, about a year ago, in the Treasury's report to Congress on the question of currencies and currency manipulation, shifted the emphasis, the focus from China to Germany. And quite correctly said that, you know, if we're worried about currency manipulation, if we're talking worried about global destabilization, we should be looking to German-driven Eurozone policies that are flooding the world with wave after wave of instability.
Okay, now let's look at the periphery. What's been happening in Greece since we last talked?
Oh, have you heard the news? We are the star performers in terms of growth. We've managed to skyrocket to 0.7% and we left everybody behind because everybody is at zero territory. So now Greece is a great success story. Now, let's be serious. Everybody talks about the turnaround, how Greece, after an untold number of quarters of shrinkage, has seen the first sign of growth. But you know what? Don't believe it. And when I say don't believe it, I'm not saying that they're lying in terms of numbers. They're lying in terms of the interpretation of the numbers. So take that 0.7% for one quarter, which they then, of course, project to an annual basis, and they've come up with a quite impressive 1.7% growth.
And that's after what sort of decline?
Oh, 26%.
Okay.
But, Doug, it's worse than it sounds. Because, let's say that we have 1.5% growth. Growth of what? Growth of real national income, real GDP. Now, we all know, don't we, that the real GDP is a ratio. On the numerator, you place the total euros earned by all Greeks, that's national income in euros, nominal GDP. But then you divide this by an index of prices to capture inflation. Now, it so happens that during the same period, if you look at the official statistics, we had deflation of 2%. So average prices fell by 2%, which means that national income in euros fell. And the only reason why they are celebrating growth is because the decline in nominal income was less than the decline in prices. Now, the problem with Greeks is that they are heavily indebted. Everybody owes to everyone and no one can pay. And the whole nation owes to the rest of the world, as we know, right? The problem is when you're indebted, your real income doesn't matter. What matters is your nominal income. How many euros do you have? Because your debt does not decline when prices fall. Your debt remains in euros. So if you have fewer euros at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether prices have fallen, you still cannot repay your debts. So you become even more insolvent as a result of these developments, which are then portrayed by the international press as Greece having turned the corner.
And, of course, that's nothing further from the truth.
Of course it isn't. If you look at the state of the Greek macroeconomy, it is a complete and utter basket case. I mean, after the one-third, one-fourth, one-third, whatever, a reduction in national income, the only thing that can really pull a nation out of that mire is investment. Now, if you look at fixed capital formation, if you look at statistics on investment, you'll find that there's been no increase in investment. If you look at credit given to small and medium enterprises, it's falling. It's falling as we speak. It's falling by 4 or 5% every quarter. Now, how can you have recovery when you're already in the grapes of wrath territory and there is no investment and no credit? It just can't be done. And it's not being done. But we have a politically inspired attempt to portray Greece as a success story.
So what does this mean for the lives of Greeks?
That it is dusty, brutish, shorter than it used to be.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the political response. Why has it taken so long for some kind of political response to what is now getting to be a fairly old crisis?
When things go bad and families lose income, their members lose their jobs, it is a natural, I believe, reaction of people to privatize their concerns and lick their wounds and try to do whatever they can in order to put food on the table. The result is that any radicalism just disappears, and what you have is a wave of pessimism that numbs people and causes them to abandon the political, the public sphere. But that doesn't last forever. And at some point, especially if there is some hope of stabilization, even at very low levels of economic and social activity, something gives, some spark ignites a fire, and especially amongst younger people who just don't believe that they deserve to live in a world that treats them as fodder, one hopes that young people will at some point say enough is enough.
What would Syriza do if it got in power or close to it?
Well, if you ask me, and you are asking me, so I'll tell you.
Tsipras is not an analogy.
One word sums it up. Negotiate. Negotiate and negotiate. Greece is part of the Eurozone. One thing we could do is to get out of it. We have already discussed this, you and I, many times. It's not an appropriate move, because it's one thing to say you shouldn't have been in there. It's quite another to say you should get out. If you're not going to get out, you have to accept that within the straitjacket of the common currency, there are very few degrees of freedom. There are very few things you can do unilaterally within that straitjacket. So the only thing you can really do is you can negotiate with the rest of Europe. But to negotiate, to be taken seriously, you have to have a credible threat. You have to be prepared to blow the whole thing up simply by being intransigent if you're not taken seriously. So this is my recommendation. Prepare for a very tough, very painful, potentially explosive negotiation.
It was Yiannis Varoufakis, an economist who's been on this show 16 times, who is now the finance minister of Greece. I'll quote again what he says at the end, quote, "But to negotiate, to be taken seriously, you have to have a credible threat. You have to be prepared to blow the whole thing up simply by being intransigent if you're not taken seriously. So this is my recommendation. Prepare for a very tough, very painful, potentially explosive negotiation." End quote. That's strong stuff. The spark of hope that he talks about just before the end can now be interpreted as the election victory of Syriza itself last week, resulting in an anti-austerity government that is now trying to reverse the bloodletting policies that have dominated for 6 years. A model and an inspiration for all of us in what seems like the latest iteration of a punctuated, disseminated global rebellion against neoliberalism after all these decades. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Bartok's piano sonata performed by Martha Argerich. Bye.